Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.11, The Young Ottomans. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. So I want to start today by mentioning that I recently had the privilege of guesting on another podcast. Drew Stockton, who is a very good friend of mine and a wonderful teacher of mindfulness, breathwork, and yoga, has a podcast called the Living Moss Podcast. And a couple of months ago, we had a great conversation on his podcast about, well, life. And we actually got to some pretty cool and interesting places in our chat about history and revolutions. So go check out Drew's Living Moss Podcast. I'll put a link for it in the show description. And I promise you'll learn something from Drew. He's an awesome and inspiring dude, and you'll get to hear me speak within a very different context than this one, which, I don't know, might be fun. I sure had fun doing it. So thanks, Drew. And with that said, let's get into it. Over the past 5 episodes, we traced the tragic sequence of events that culminated with the Hamidian massacres of 1894 to 1896. And as we saw, these massacres were perpetrated by Sultan Abdulhamid's government and the other reactionary elements of his empire against the Christians of Eastern Anatolia and Constantinople, specifically the Armenians and the Assyrians. And while we have been honed in on Armenian freedom fighters who took up arms to defend Christian civilians, during this period in the early to mid-1890s, the broader Ottoman Empire had been going through a period of more generalized unrest, with the Hamidian massacres being simply the most dramatic event within a period of fairly widespread mass chaos. And the instability of the 1890s will ultimately open up a rift within the ruling class of the Ottoman Empire. And it will be this rupture within the ruling class that will finally ripen the ongoing crisis of the late Ottoman Empire, as events are brought to a dramatic head in 1908 with the Young Turk Revolution. And the reason that the Hamidian massacres were such a salient event, and why it would really begin to push things towards revolution, is because they brought to the foreground the two chronic issues facing the empire. First was the threat of foreign intervention, as it was widely feared that either Russia or Great Britain would militarily intervene on behalf of the Armenians and potentially carve up the empire in the process. And then second was the simple continued presence of Abdulhamid as an autocratic tyrant, unwilling to share power with anyone else. And these two recurrent issues will solidify the fault lines of this split in the Ottoman ruling class, really more than anything else. Because if Abdulhamid was both unwilling to share power and unable to protect the empire from foreign incursion, then what use was he at all? So today, we are turning our attention towards this split in the ruling class of the empire. And it is kind of interesting, because in this series on the revolutions of the Ottoman collapse, which is nearing its 30th episode, by the way, split between these two seasons, we actually haven't spent all that much time talking about revolutionary Muslims of the Islamic Ottoman Empire. And the reason for this is that over the roughly 100-year period we've been covering, revolutionary energy, for the most part, came from the Christian populations of the Ottoman Empire. We've got the Serbs, then the Greeks, then the Romanians, then the Bulgarians, and most recently, the Armenians. Put simply, 19th century revolutions in the Ottoman Empire, which, as we know, there were quite a lot of, were almost as a rule initiated by Christian separatists residing in the peripheral territories of the empire, who sought to achieve home rule through winning either autonomy within or independence from the Ottoman Empire. Of course, there are many exceptions to this, exceptions that we have already talked about and exceptions that we will talk much more about later on. Muhammad Ali down in Egypt, Ubaydullah and his band of Kurdish rebels, and of course the Albanians, who I know I have been neglecting, but don't you worry, we will get to the Albanians, I promise. But the point I want to make here is that even though there had always been resistance, unrest, and outright revolt within Muslim populations of the Ottoman Empire, this resistance usually had a distinctly different character than that of, say, the Greek, Bulgarian, or Armenian revolutionaries. with the two possible exceptions of Urabi's revolt down in Egypt and the Albanians. Throughout the 19th century, unrest and rebellion amongst the Muslim populations of the empire tended to revolve around the loss of status and privilege of formerly powerful leaders, such as Ali Pasha in northern Greece, or Muhammad Ali in Egypt, or Ubaydullah and the Kurds. Revolutionary unrest amongst the Christians of the empire, on the other hand, tended to be much more influenced by European revolutionary ideology, with its origins in the French Revolution. And so the movements amongst Christians tended to be much more nationalistic in character. As we will see, a real turning point will come once revolutionary nationalism gains traction amongst the Muslims of the empire. One of the greatest strengths of the Ottoman system had always been its ability to fold local leaders into the imperial structure by offering privileges and autonomy to power brokers out in the provinces. While some of these leaders were Christian, the vast majority were Muslim because they could much more easily be folded into the Ottoman system, which privileged Muslims. But once Muslim Albanians, Arabs, Kurds, Circassians, Egyptians, and eventually Turks themselves begin to dream of establishing independent national homelands like their Christian counterparts, well, the Ottoman Empire will truly begin to crumble beneath the weight of its own contradictions. But in the 1890s, this final collapse of the Ottoman Empire was still nearly 30 years down the road, and revolutionary nationalism had still not gained much traction at all amongst Ottoman Muslims. And the 1908 Constitutional Revolution, the climax of this second season, will actually be launched specifically in order to save the Ottoman Empire from its final collapse, not to hasten it. So, the split in the ruling class of the Ottoman Empire, a split that will create the conditions for the Constitutional Revolution of 1908, will initially come about as a result of elite Muslims beginning to criticize and resist Sultan Abdul Hamid and his government with an increasing level of fierceness. Meaning that the type of revolutionaries that we will now be focusing on are quite different from the Greek Klephs and the Bulgarian Cheti and the Armenian Fedayi of past episodes. Because even though the Young Turks will come to be influenced by and eventually joined by such Christian freedom fighters and guerrillas, the leaders of the Young Turk Revolution will be primarily drawn from the Muslim professional classes. The imperial bureaucrats, provincial administrators and religious scholars, the doctors, lawyers, and translators, the university students, professors, and scientists, and most importantly, the junior army officers. And because the Young Turks will emerge from these elite circles, many of them will at first be opposed to using radical revolutionary tactics, again, at least initially. Because in the Ottoman Empire, revolutions and uprisings and terrorism were often viewed as sort of a Christian thing. Uprisings and revolutions were associated with the separatist movements of the Serbs, Greeks, and Bulgarians. So Muslim elites of the opposition tended to limit their activities to petitions, politicking, journalism, and, if absolutely necessary, the old palace coup. What this means is that in some ways we can mark the beginning of the revolution as the moment when these oppositional elements within the Muslim ruling class begin to adopt revolutionary tactics that were previously the purview of Christian separatists in their fight against Sultan Abdul Hamid and his government. Ultimately, this radicalization of the Muslim opposition is the story of the Young Turk Revolution, the story that we will now tell in full. When we go looking for the early roots of this split within the empire's ruling elite, we come across a group known to history as the Young Ottomans. And we've actually talked about the Young Ottomans quite a bit in past episodes, but it has sort of been in passing, like when we looked at the Great Eastern Crisis and the series of coups that ultimately brought Abdul Hamid to power and that were primarily orchestrated by this group known as the Young Ottomans. But the Young Ottomans do require closer examination, first and foremost because they are the ideological forebears of the later Young Turks, and second, there is just often a lot of confusion about who exactly the Young Ottomans really were, and how they can exactly be differentiated from the Young Turks. This question of how to separate the young Ottomans from the young Turks is actually surprisingly hard to answer, because the earlier group, who we now call the young Ottomans, were very often referred to as the Young Turkey Party, and by some as the Young Turks, during their heyday in the 1860s and 1870s. So yes, the moniker of the Young Turks was used to describe members of the Muslim opposition as early as the mid-19th century, to describe the group we now call the Young Ottomans. And during their time, the Young Ottomans actually called themselves the New Ottomans, because there was a bad association in the empire with names like Young Ottomans or Young Turks, because such names were generally viewed as being linked somehow to radicalism and romantic nationalism in Europe. Think Young Italy and the other groups inspired by Giuseppe Mazzini, like Young Germany and Young Poland, which played a key role in the rise of romantic nationalism in Europe that would culminate with the 1848 revolutions. Again, this type of revolutionary nationalism was generally looked down upon in the mid-19th century Ottoman Empire. But even though they called themselves the New Ottomans, this loose-knit group of reformers within the Ottoman elite were quite often still referred to by outsiders, especially those in Europe, as Young Ottomans or even Young Turks, because they came to be associated with the Romantic nationalist movements of Europe. And so this is where these names originally come from European observers kind of misunderstanding the nature of these reform movements in the Ottoman Empire. And this misunderstanding kind of persists somewhat to this day, and the confusion ultimately centers around the relationship that the Young Ottomans and the early Young Turks would have with revolutionary nationalism. The Young Ottomans were not, I repeat, not revolutionary nationalists. And in fact, revolutionary nationalism was the very thing they were perhaps most opposed to. For context, Young Ottomans emerged as an oppositional group during the height of the Tanzimat era of reform in the mid-1860s. The original core of the Young Ottomans would emerge from the Ottoman bureaucracy at the Sublime Porte, which had grown significantly as a result of government reforms during the Tanzimat. More specifically, nearly all of the original members of the Young Ottomans worked at the Imperial Translation Office, which meant that they often dealt with European statesmen. So the Young Ottomans were exposed to European forms of governance and European thought on a daily basis. And furthermore, as members of the Sublime Porte bureaucracy, these young men also had an insider view into the inner workings of their own government. And when they compared the governments of Western Europe to their own government, they were disappointed. And a lot of them also had some personal beef with the leading administrators of the Tanzimat government during this era, specifically two men named Fuad Pasha and Ali Pasha, who would sort of just rotate as grand viziers during this era in the 1860s and who drove a lot of Ottoman policies, especially when it came to foreign relations with Europe. So along with having ideological issues with the current state of the Ottoman Empire, a lot of the Young Ottomans also just personally disliked these two leaders, Fuad and Ali, whom the Young Ottomans saw as overly authoritarian and also as weak in dealing with the European powers, giving in to their demands far too easily. In the mid-1860s, these reformers would begin to express their feelings of disappointment with their government in newspapers and journals. And eventually, these dissenters at the translation office would come together to form what was not exactly a secret society, but what was like a semi-secret group, which they called the New Ottomans. And in time, this society would actually come to influence and have contact with some very important people, including two young princes within the Sultan's family, the nephews of the reigning Sultan Abdul Aziz. These two princes were none other than Prince Murad and Prince Abdul Hamid. So, yep, that's right. Abdul Hamid, the future Red Sultan, who would establish his personalized autocratic rule after coming to power in 1876, was, at one time, at least associated with the Young Ottomans. But even though Abdul Hamid would forge a few connections with these liberal reformers as a young prince, Abdul Hamid's brother, Murad, was much more directly connected to the Young Ottomans. And Murad would actually be the first and only Ottoman Sultan to join the Freemasons, as Murad would, along with many other young Ottomans, become a member of the Grand Lodge of Turkey, after Freemasonry had been legalized as part of the Tanzimat reforms. And looking ahead just a bit, Freemason lodges will be a very important incubator of reform and of revolution in the coming decades. In the years leading up to 1908, Masonry would provide a semi-secret but still legal space in which educated people could meet and discuss big ideas like what needed to be done to save the empire. And perhaps most importantly, within Freemason lodges, members could theoretically operate on an equal playing field as fellow Masons. So lodges would include Muslims, Christians, and Jews, who were given the opportunity to co-mingle and have open debates. So Freemason lodges would play an especially important role in forging early alliances between different ethno-religious groups, as the broader Ottoman society was otherwise pretty much segregated. Tanzimat reformers had technically declared religious equality following the Crimean War in 1856. But this reform edict had not been carried out in any real meaningful way, and the different millets of the empire, the state-recognized ethno-religious groups, continued to live in almost entirely segregated communities. And this was the sort of thing that the young Ottomans would criticize about the Tanzimat government. The reforms did not go far enough and were not carried through with sufficient rigor. Creating a more centralized government with a rationalized bureaucracy was a good start, but if the empire was going to truly advance to the level of Western Europe, everyone needed to be made into legally equal citizens in the style of the French Revolution, coming together not as Muslims, Greeks, Armenians, and Jews, but as Ottomans. So, such topics were freely discussed amongst Muslim, Christians, and Jews within Freemason lodges. And it shouldn't surprise you that another member of the Grand Turkey Lodge, alongside Prince Murad, was none other than our old friend Midhat Pasha, future author of the 1876 Constitution, who, during the early 1870s, would also become associated with the young Ottomans, like Prince Murad, even though they were never really fully members of the society. But the fact that a powerful statesman like Midhat Pasha and the likely heir to the Ottoman throne, Prince Murad, were both mingling with the young Ottomans and joining Freemason lodges should give you an idea of the spirit of the age. And since we spent so much time talking about all of the terrible things that would happen for the Ottomans following the Great Eastern Crisis of 1876, it's hard to remember that the 1860s and early 1870s was actually a time of optimism. At this point, the Ottomans were still riding high from their victory over the Russians during the Crimean War. And because the British and the French had been so instrumental in assuring this victory for the Ottomans, there was still a general feeling of openness towards the adoption of Western-style reforms and towards working with these Western great powers. The young Ottomans were at the vanguard of the effort to westernize the empire. But one caveat that needs to be emphasized within these efforts at westernization is that while the young Ottomans pushed for Western-style reform, the purpose was to specifically combat the increasing influence of Western powers over Ottoman affairs. Because remember, they saw Tanzimat leaders like Ali Pasha and Fuad Pasha as too soft when it came to dealing with the Europeans. So for the young Ottomans, it was kind of that classic use the tools of your enemy against your enemy. In short, the young Ottomans generally believed that parliamentary government and some sort of constitution that could check the autocratic power of the Sultan were essential steps needed to reinvigorate the empire, which would allow the Ottomans to prevent further European encroachment and European meddling. Even though Prince Murad and Midhat Pasha were certainly the most powerful people associated with the young Ottomans, largely because they were so powerful, they still weren't literally members of the young Ottoman societies. So the two men who would emerge as some of the most outspoken and most prolific voices who were direct members of the young Ottoman group were Ibrahim Senyasi and Namik Kemal. The older of the two, Ibrahim Senyasi, was born in Istanbul in 1826 and grew up within an elite Ottoman family. Sinyasi's father was a war hero who died fighting in the Russo-Turkish War following the Greek Revolution when Sinyasi was still quite young. As a young man, Ibrahim Sinyasi would earn a government grant to study abroad in Paris. And while in Paris, he would become friends with some pretty prominent French intellectuals, including Alphonse de Lamartine, the French writer and public official who would help to found the Second French Republic after the February Revolution of 1848. Lamartine also wrote one of the earliest popular histories of the French Revolution, which traced the rise of the Girondin faction within the Jacobins. The friendship between Ibrahim Sinyasi and Lamartine would establish an early link between the opposition movements of the Ottoman Empire and French radical politics. This link would carry on into the next generation of young Turks, as people like Ahmed Reza would, two decades later, also settle in Paris and follow the young Ottomans into the French intellectual scene as émigrés. Ibrahim Sinyasi spent most of his time in France translating works of literature and political philosophy into Ottoman Turkish. And Sinyasi produced some of the very first translations of works from the European Enlightenment. And these translations would have a major influence on the next generation of educated Ottoman elites, injecting a healthy dose of French radical politics into the younger generation. When Sinyasi returned home to Istanbul, he would start up a newspaper that would be one of the very first privately owned papers to actually have somewhat of a wide readership. And this popularity largely stemmed from the fact that Sinyasi wrote the paper in a more commonly used version of Turkish instead of the typical Ottoman Turkish, which was pretty much only used in the palace. So Sinyasi's paper was written in this more accessible form of Turkish, and at first it focused on the everyday happenings within the empire. But Sinyasi would later begin to use his paper in order to push for more westernization and for the inclusion of Western Enlightenment ideals within the education of everyday Ottomans. And in his push for westernizing reforms, Sinyasi even began to criticize, sort of, Sultan Abdul Aziz and other prominent leaders of the Tanzimat. And even though these government critiques were still pretty mild, when they were coupled with the growing popularity of the paper, Sinyasi was put on the radar of the imperial government, and he would be forced into exile in 1865. And Sinyasi would elect to spend his exile back in Paris. When Sinyasi was being forced to leave Istanbul, he would transfer the operation of his paper to one of his employees, a young and fiery journalist by the name of Namik Kemal. Namik Kemal was a very bright young man who had begun working in the Imperial Translation Office at the ripe young age of 17. However, Kemal was also a poet, novelist, and playwright. And after his boss at the translation office read some of his literary works, he found them a bit too radical for his liking, and so Kemal was fired. He would then find work as an editor for Ibrahim Sinyasi's paper, and when Sinyasi was exiled to Paris, Kemal would elect to take over management of the paper. Under Kemal's leadership, the paper became even more outspoken in its push for westernizing reforms within the empire. And so Kemal would himself be forced into exile after just 2 years, and the paper would be temporarily shut down. Namik Kemal would choose to join his friend and old boss, Ibrahim Sinyasi, in Paris. And the two would continue writing pamphlets, journals, and newspapers that would be even more pointed in their criticisms of the Ottoman administration. And Kemal would also follow Sinyasi in the great task of translating works of French literature and political philosophy into Ottoman Turkish. These translations by Namik Kemal would include works by writers such as Victor Hugo, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Charles-Louis Montesquieu. And along with Sinyasi's translations, these would be some of the very first translations of such books into Turkish. And Kemal and Sinyasi's hope was always that they might be able to inject liberal ideas from the West into Ottoman society. Ideas like freedom of speech, religious equality, representative government, constitutions, separation of powers, and loyalty to one's country over loyalty to a ruling sovereign. As we have said, these translations of French literature and political philosophy would be very important in shaping the political ideology of the next generation of Ottoman intellectuals, including many future leaders of the Young Turks. Now, an interesting development within this period was that Namık Kemal and other young Ottomans living in Paris would actually come to have their activities funded by none other than the grandson of Muhammad Ali, the great Egyptian modernizer who had established the autonomous Egyptian Khedive in the early 19th century. So Mustafa Fazil was the third son of Ibrahim Pasha, whom you may remember was himself the son of Muhammad Ali and the Pasha's greatest general, who had led the campaigns against the Greek revolutionaries and then later against the Sultan's armies. So Mustafa Fazil was a very powerful and very rich dude. And the reason he started associating himself with the young Ottomans is because he had recently been boxed out of the line of succession to be the next Khedive of Egypt. Mustafa Fazil's older brother was Ismail, whom we talked about in episode 2.4, The Veiled Protectorate, as he was the Khedive who had spent all of Egypt's money on fancy buildings and cool statues and set the Egyptian government on course for future bankruptcy. And well, Ismail had colluded with Sultan Abdul Aziz to change the succession order of the Khedive so that it no longer passed to the oldest living male relative, but instead to the son of the ruling Khedive. This meant that Tawfiq, Ismail's son, who was at this point just a teenager, was now to be next in line to be the Khedive of Egypt instead of Mustafa Fazil. As you might expect, the fact that Sultan Abdul Aziz had helped his older brother screw him over made Mustafa Fazil super dang mad, and so the Egyptian nobles spent the next several years funding oppositional groups like the Young Ottomans. And at this same time, in the late 1860s, Mustafa Fazil also began writing open letters condemning Sultan Abdul Aziz and his ministers Fuad and Ali. More specifically, Mustafa Fazil began to argue for the need for liberalizing reforms that would check the arbitrary power of the Sultan and his ministers, specifically arguing for the establishment of a constitution and a parliament. Then, Mustafa Fazil also lamented the fact that the Ottoman Empire had begun to decline in recent years, and he argued that this decline was due to the fact that Ottoman society had devolved into two distinct classes, or as he put it, those who oppress without restraint and those who are oppressed. And in making these critiques, he on multiple occasions compared Ottoman society of his day with that of pre-revolutionary France before 1789. And along with disparaging the Ottoman Empire of his own time, Mustafa Fazil also praised the glorious Ottoman past when the sultans were some of the most powerful figures in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Even though the Ottoman government would make sure that these open letters would not be widely published, these letters did circulate amongst the young Ottomans, and in time, Mustafa Fazil's oppositional ideas would proliferate and have a pretty significant impact. Four young Ottomans like Namık Kemal, whose activities were also being paid for by the Egyptian heir's enormous wealth, the simple bravado and gall of him standing up to the Sultan and his ministers in such a public manner, and doing so in a way that was still patriotic and took pride in the glorious Ottoman past, was quite inspirational. Around 1870, Namık Kemal was allowed to return home to Istanbul. And somewhat predictably, he went straight back to his work as an oppositional journalist and radical poet. But in the coming years, it would not be his work as a journalist, poet, or translator that would have the greatest impact, but instead his work as a playwright. On April 1st, 1873, Namık Kemal would debut a play entitled Fatherland or Silistra at the Ottoman Theater in Istanbul. And it really would be Kemal's play, Fatherland or Silistra, that would truly begin to propagate liberal Enlightenment values coming out of the West amongst everyday Ottomans. The plot of Fatherland or Silistra reenacted the 1854 siege of Silistra, the the Great Ottoman Victory during the Crimean War, in which the Ottomans successfully put a stop to the Russian invasion of Ottoman Europe. On the night the play premiered, Namik Kemal ended his show by coming out to address the crowd. And after the audience had been thoroughly roused by his dramatic reenactment of the Ottoman victory over the invading Russians, Kemal called upon his audience, saying, "O Mujahids, ready to die in the protection of the fatherland, come on, don't you have a voice? Long live the fatherland, long live the Ottomans." The crowd was then asked to join in on a staged protest, and the audience began chanting these patriotic phrases, "Long live the fatherland, long live the Ottomans." Namik Kemal had specifically modeled his play off of Victor Hugo's work, Hernani, which itself had caused a small riot to break out in the Parisian theater where it was premiered in 1830, just months before the outbreak of the July Revolution in France. And just as had happened at the premiere of Victor Hugo's play, after Namik Kemal roused his audience with these patriotic lines, a small riot would break out in the Ottoman theater, and this riot would spill out into the streets of Istanbul and eventually grow into a full-blown protest against the reigning Sultan Abdul Aziz. As the play's audience left the theater and entered onto the streets, they began adding to their patriotic slogans the phrase, "We want Murad," in reference to the potential successor to the Ottoman throne and the liberal Freemason and darling of the young Ottomans, Prince Murad. Well, seeing as he had just caused an anti-government riot to break out in the imperial capital, Namik Kemal was promptly arrested, shipped off to Cyprus, and thrown into a prison for the next 3 years. But the damage was done. Namik Kemal's play had successfully introduced two concepts into Ottoman society that would, in time, become explosive in their impact: freedom and fatherland. Namik Kemal would die in 1888 while living in exile. But he would go on to be a hero of the Young Turks, sitting right alongside Midhat Pasha and Ibrahim Sanyasi as one of the great martyrs of the young Ottoman generation. In his groundbreaking play, Fatherland or Silistra, Namik Kemal had riled up the crowd by chanting, "Long live the fatherland, long live the Ottomans." As an intellectual in the early 1870s, Kemal had premiered his play at the height of Tanzimat-era optimism. This was 5 years before Russia would invade the empire yet again and set off the catastrophic chain of events which would eventually see the empire lose 2/5 of its territory at the Congress of Berlin. And it was more than 20 years before the resentment and paranoia following this defeat would create the terrible divides between Muslims and Christians of the empire that would culminate in the Hamidian massacres. What this means is that when Namik Kemal made reference to the fatherland, he was not referring to a Turkish homeland, or even to an exclusively Islamic homeland. Instead, he was referring to an Ottoman homeland, and this is a very important distinction. The subtitle of this play, coming after the term fatherland, is Silistra, which was a small fortress town on the Danube River, and which today sits on the northeastern border of Romania and Bulgaria. This subtitle was not simply chosen due to the fact that its plot follows the siege of Silistra, but rather the fortress of Silistra, sitting along the Danube, was conceived of as a central part of the so-called fatherland of the Ottomans. Because in 1873, when Namik Kemal's play was written, the Ottomans had ruled this area of the Balkans for over 500 years, literally ever since 1365. For the Ottomans, the territories of Bulgaria, Thrace, and Macedonia were all part of what they called Rumelia. And for centuries, the territory of the southern Balkans and western Anatolia, the geographic area surrounding Istanbul, had been the heart of the Ottoman Empire, economically, politically, spiritually. So when Namik Kemal made reference to the fatherland, it was not understood at the time as solely meaning the Anatolian Peninsula, today's territory of modern Turkey. Instead, it was understood as including the entirety of the Ottoman Empire,
So this included Anatolia, yes, but to an even greater extent, when Nami Kemal said fatherland, he meant Rumelia, the core of the empire in southeastern Europe and western Anatolia. This had long been the heart of the Ottoman fatherland. For the young Turks who would form the next generation following Nami Kemal, this conception of the Ottoman fatherland would remain. And many of the future revolutionary leaders who would take control of the empire following 1908, people like the three pashas, Talat Enver Jemal, as well as Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, they all hailed from historic Rumelia in southeastern Europe. And though the term Rumi had since fallen out of fashion, there still remained a certain pride in being from this territory in the empire's core. And this is why the loss of the Ottoman Empire's European territories would be such a big deal in 1876 for the young Ottomans, and why the further loss of territory for the later young Turks during the Balkan Wars in 1912 would be an even bigger deal, as they were forced to fundamentally alter their ideology as they redefined what the fatherland even was, putting more emphasis on Anatolia and on Turkishness. So, Nami Kemal introduced the idea of fatherland into the lexicon of Ottoman society. And for elite Ottomans, the fatherland was understood as southeastern Europe and western Anatolia. This is an important distinction for a few reasons. First off, Nami Kemal would have a major influence on later Turkish nationalists. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and there is no relation, by the way, even though Atatürk would proudly use his middle name Kemal, often pointed to Nami Kemal as an influential thinker on his development of Turkish nationalist ideology. But even though this influence of Nami Kemal is real, during Nami Kemal's time, Turkism and Turkish nationalism, as we understand them today, were just not really a thing yet. Now, Nami Kemal was very important in beginning to develop the modern Turkish language in his use of a more accessible form of the language in his newspapers. Atatürk would finalize this process through his later gigantic language reforms of the Turkish language. And then Nami Kemal also saw himself as an advocate for the common Turkish peasant and worker, whom he saw as just generally oppressed. But with all of that said, there is a reason why Nami Kemal chanted, "Long live the Ottomans," and not "Long live the Turks." When he said Ottomans, he meant the Ottomans, and this included Turks, Arabs, Albanians, Armenians, Greeks, Jews, Circassians, Egyptians, Bulgarians, Macedonians, and on and on and on. When Nami Kemal debuted his play, Fatherland or Silistra, he premiered it at the Ottoman Theater, which was owned and operated by an Armenian actor and director known as Gulu Egop. And while it might seem strange that this play by Nami Kemal, who is often pointed to as an early example of proto-Turkish nationalism, would be premiered at a theater owned by an Armenian, this only seems strange in retrospect, knowing what is to come over the next 50 years. Like we said earlier, this play was premiered over 20 years before the Hamidian massacres. This was the height of the Tanzimat and the height of optimism surrounding Ottomanism. The idea that the Ottoman Empire should be a pluralistic society in which civic equality was guaranteed between the different religious and ethnic groups. And this brings us back to revolutionary nationalism. Nami Kemal, Ibrahim Sanyasi, Midhat Pasha, and the young Ottomans were not nationalists, at least not in the sense that is typically understood. Instead, they are better understood as unionists, meaning that one of their overriding goals was to reform the empire in such a way as to make it more unified. Because even though the Balkan uprisings of the Great Eastern Crisis were still 3 years down the road when Nami Kemal premiered Fatherland or Silistra, revolutionary nationalism was still very much on the rise amongst the Christians living in the empire's periphery. The young Ottomans hoped to construct a new imperial identity, the Ottomans, that can include all of the Sultan's subjects, no matter their religion, no matter their ethnicity. And this is why the young Ottomans would stress the need for equality between the different religions of the empire. It was to appease, undermine, and combat the nationalist aspirations of the Bulgarians, Greeks, Serbs, and Romanians. And this is also why this concept of fatherland was so critical for Nami Kemal's version of Ottomanism. Through evoking a fatherland, loyalty was subtly being shifted away from loyalty to a religion and towards loyalty to a geographic region. Loyalty to the Ottoman fatherland. This was a kind of new concept within the Ottoman Empire, in which people had always been separated into their different millets, meaning that people as a rule most identified with their ethno-religious communities. The young Ottomans, and in many ways the Tanzimat leaders as well, wanted to forge a new Ottoman identity so that people could move away from their historic loyalty to their millets in order to become loyal citizens of a united Ottoman nation. But this Ottoman nation was not built upon an imagined ethnic past in the way that the Greek or Bulgarian nations were. The Ottoman nation was bound by geography, by empire, by the figurehead of the Sultan, and by a shared commitment to a pluralistic and diverse society of equal citizens. This is a very different type of nation than the ethnic-based nation-states emerging in Europe during this same time, in places like Italy, France, Germany, and Greece. So, this is Ottomanism, an ideology that will persist for decades to come. And Ottomanism will be the foundation stone for the early Young Turks leading up to the 1908 Constitutional Revolution. And this early dedication of the Young Turks to an inclusive, pluralistic society in which equality between the religious groups was guaranteed will be the reason why the movement will attract so many different diverse groups of people into their ranks. And it will also be the reason why so many people will become disillusioned and angry once the core members of the Young Turks gradually turn their backs on Ottomanism and come to be driven instead by Turkish nationalism. But that is for later. Now, we know all too well how the first experiment in Ottomanism and in representative government in the late 1870s will end, as Midhat Pasha initiates his series of coups amidst the crisis atmosphere surrounding the empire's declaration of bankruptcy and the outbreak of revolutionary uprisings in Bulgaria and Bosnia-Herzegovina. The first of these coups would bring Prince Murad, darling of the young Ottomans, to power. But the poor guy would only last for a few months before having a mental breakdown. Then with Murad gone, Midhat Pasha would turn to his second choice, to the prince who had at times flirted with the young Ottomans, but who had never really fully committed to their cause. And so Abdul Hamid would be brought to the throne by Midhat Pasha. And the promulgation of the 1876 Constitution by Abdul Hamid and Midhat Pasha would be the great crowning event of the young Ottoman movement. Or at least it should have been. Because, as we know, things would come to be driven by events outside of the capital, as the Russians use the Bulgarian horrors as a pretext to invade the Ottoman Empire. And the next thing you know, two-fifths of the empire's territory is being carved up by the scheming great powers, as Britain and France reveal themselves to be two-faced, backstabbing liars, who only sided with the Ottomans when it benefited them geopolitically within this cold new world under Bismarck's realpolitik. So, amidst the crisis of war and financial ruin, Abdul Hamid would throw away the 1876 Constitution like it was yesterday's mail, suspending the parliament and asserting his personalized autocratic rule for the next 30 years. But even though the young Ottomans would be smothered under the repressive blanket of Abdul Hamid's absolutism and ever-present secret police, the embers of Ottomanism would continue to slowly burn throughout the 1880s. And moving into the 1890s, these embers would begin to be nursed back to life as the Muslim opposition reemerges within the royal universities of the empire, amongst the students who were now reading the translations of Western political thought brought over by Nami Kemal and Ibrahim Sanyasi. And so, next week, four students at the Royal Medical Academy will get together in order to form a student group with the goal of resisting the administration's new censorship policies at the Royal Universities. And even though they did not know it at the time, these four medical students would found a society that would, in less than 20 years, bring Abdul Hamid to his knees and force him to reinstate the 1876 Constitution of Midhat Pasha and the Young Ottomans. And before you say anything, I know, I already said their name dramatically at the end of last episode. But you know, they are really important and their name sounds cool, so I'm just gonna do it again. Join me next time as we finally, for real this time, introduce the Committee of Union and Progress.